It's another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And today we have a terrific guest, and it's a fitting day to have this podcast released because it is the 50th anniversary of the death of the great Jack Kerouac. I was saying recently, I kind of find it interesting that when someone we know and love dies, we're all broken up, and then I guess it's 50 years goes by. A lot of times it's 100 years, but you're like, hooray, it's the anniversary of their death, and interesting, we human beings. At any rate, so our guest today is Gerald Nicosia, who goes by Jerry, and he is the author of probably the best biography of Jack Kerouac ever written, called Memory Babe. I know he thinks it's the best one ever written. I'd probably agree. I read it. Somebody gave a copy of it to me, I don't know, in like the early 90s, and it blew my mind. I was a big fan of Jack Kerouac when I was younger. I'm still a fan of Jack Kerouac. I don't read him. I think everybody should read Kerouac when they're like 18 to 25, something like that. You should read all his books. They're great, and it'll, you know, really inspire you. I read some recently, and it was a mixed bag. I'll put it to you that way. I love Dharma Bums. I thought Big Sur was terrible. So there you go. But at any rate, we had a really good conversation. It was an easy one because I just, you know, had to say a couple of things here and there. And Jerry filled in all the blanks. Jerry is very, very passionate about the subject of Jack Kerouac. He's very passionate about Jack's daughter, Jan, who is basically screwed out of her inheritance due to a forged will. And I was speaking with a friend of mine, who I shall leave anonymous, who was good friends with Allen Ginsberg. And he told me that when all this stuff that was going on, the NYU symposium in like 94 that Jerry talks about in this interview, and also in his new book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century, which is all about the inheritance fight. At any rate, he was going around saying that Kerouac's mother's will had been forged. And he said, we all thought he was nuts. Well, it turns out Jerry was right. So he is, so maybe he's right about a lot of things. Maybe he's right about a lot of the other things he talks about. I'll leave you to judge that for yourself. At any rate, there is some weird stuff going on for sure. I mean, I was shocked when somebody told me recently that Memory Babe was out of print because it's kind of a classic. You can hunt down a copy of it if you want to. But I mean, if you are a fan of Jack Kerouac, it's an absolute must read. And there was things in there that I found very interesting, but I think were very upsetting to his quote-unquote legacy as, you know, read money-earning potential, because Jerry didn't hold back when he was talking about Jack's bisexuality and his drug use and what he was like towards the end of his life, which was really not a pretty picture. And I think the people who manage his image weren't very happy about that. But at any rate, I'll leave you to judge that for yourself. Man, what a week it's been. Last week, we released three books. Count them, three. We put out the Sensitive Skin Anthology, Selected Writing, 2016 to 2018. Put out The Last Poet of the Village, which is selected poems by Sergei Yesenin, the great Russian poet, translated by Anton Yakovlev. And we put out my novel, There's Never Been a Better Time to Die, which is a neo-noir meta-satire of late-stage capitalism in Marin County, featuring a hard-boiled realtor. And people like all these books. Yeah, they're good. And you can get those all on Amazon, of course, or any online retailer. Barnes & Noble will have them. And you can order them from your local bookseller if you don't like dealing with those cocksuckers. And they're also all available, though, going back to those wonderful people at Amazon, they are all available at a low price for Kindles. They're like $4.99 if you can't afford the print copies. But yeah, ask your local bookseller or your librarian. Go request it from your librarian. They'll get it for you. And then yesterday we did Lit Crawl. And that was fun. I read with Jenny Wade, who read from Mayakovsky Maximum Access, and Mark Olmsted was there, and his wife Susie Kaplan Olmsted, and Joel Landmine, and it was really fun. We had a good time. And that's actually going to be next week's podcast. I'll play you a recording of that reading, because it was a good one. At any rate, without further ado, here's my conversation with Jerry Nicosia. But anyway, so we were talking earlier about the film version of On the Road.
And so we're actually on the air here. Are we recording for posterity?
Yeah.
Okay. The film version of On the Road. Well, I was asked to be an advisor to the movie by Walter Salles, and they flew me up to Montreal, which is where all the... they called it Beat Boot Camp. It was where all the prep for the movie was being done. The actors were there, and I was supposed to be a coach to several of the actors, but especially to Kristen Stewart, because I had, you know, 12 hours of tapes with Lou Anne Henderson. I was one of the few people that had spent that much time and taped that much with her. She's the character of Mary Lou in On the Road, and she was very reclusive and didn't talk to too many people. She had died just before they made the movie, before they started the movie, the real Lou Anne. So I mean the real Mary Lou, Lou Anne Henderson. And Kristen Stewart was playing the part of Lou Anne / Mary Lou. But I ran into a lot of problems with the producers up there. A couple of French guys with a company called MK2. And they were making it on a low budget, which a lot of films in France are, and they borrowed a lot of money, and they were really afraid of losing their money. And they were saying, in order to get our money back, we got to have lots of sex and lots of drugs in this movie.
You know,
lots of Benzedrine, lots of naked shots of Kristen Stewart. And I was trying to tell them that On the Road is not about sex and drugs. It's not the reason people love that book. You've got all these millions of people that love the book, but I've yet to find one person who said, I love On the Road because of the sex and drugs.
Yeah.
They love it. People love On the Road because it's a spiritual book. It's about finding your identity, finding who you are. What is the meaning of your time here on earth, you know? And when I told the producers that this was a spiritual book, they were freaking out. They were saying, like, what? We can't make a spiritual movie. Are you crazy?
Right.
And I'm saying, but actually, if you look at the book, there's tremendous scenes. There's a scene of God's finger in the clouds above Colorado pointing to Jack and saying, go thou and tell truly about man. And you've got this old character and wandering the roads with a long beard that looks like Job. And I said, you could have some of these scenes that bring out the spirituality. And they were like, no, we're going to do the sex and the drugs. And they did, and the movie bombed. And the actors really wanted to do it the right way. I really liked all of the actors.
Who else was in that?
Sam Riley played Jack Kerouac. Neil Cassidy, I'm blocking his name now. Garrett Hedlund. And, of course, Kristen Stewart played Lou Anne. They really wanted Viggo Mortensen played Burroughs. They all wanted to do a good job.
He was good.
And a little cameo. But basically the script was so bad, it really didn't catch the intelligence of Jack and Neil. It was all about, hey, let's go get high.
I wonder if it's actually an unfilmable book.
Oh, no, it's not. I'm telling you. Bernard, I mean, if you look at On the Road, there's amazing scenes that if you filmed them, this would be a surrealistic, amazingly spiritual book. There's a great scene, one of the greatest scenes in On the Road is Jack is starving in San Francisco. This is after Neil has abandoned him and Lou Anne has thrown him out. And he's wandering the streets of San Francisco, starving to death. And he's over, you know, beard grown out and unshaven, and he looks in a bakery window, and he's just mouth watering at the pastries and the things, and he has no money to buy anything. Mm-hmm. And the woman inside, you know, some old Greek proprietress or something, slams the blinds down like she's afraid he's a thief. And he says, I suddenly remembered, you know, my lifetime 200 years ago when I was a thief in England. starving and stealing food. And he said, and then suddenly the skies opened and a million golden angels poured out of the heavens. I mean, it's an amazing scene, yeah, you know. And yeah. he says, I suddenly stepped off the plank of time into timeless eternity or something like that. I mean, if you were to film that scene, you know, of him look staring at that food and then hallucinating all these golden angels coming out of the sky, I mean, that would be an incredible scene.
Yeah.
Which would really catch the essence of On the Road far more than 25 nude shots of Kristen Stewart. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I do think, though, that because of that, that spiritual essence is hard to capture, and you'd need an incredibly talented filmmaker to do that.
The scenes are there,
that,
Bernard.
You know?
He's got the scene. That old man, and he appears four or five times in On the Road. They call him the walking saint of On the Road. He's this old bearded man, looks like Job, and every 100 miles they see him coming down the road, and he's saying, "Go moan for man, go moan for man." That's Job.
Yeah.
That's a filmable scene. That's an absolutely filmable. It's a beautifully filmable scene. The old bearded man, the ragged clothes on the road, go moan for man. You put those scenes in. Kerouac gives you those scenes, but they didn't want those scenes. You know?
It's unfortunate. But I don't know. I mean, I've just, this is something I've seen for, it seemed like about 30 years ago, there was this rush to film like a lot of the, underground's not quite the right word, but literature to make like these literary films. And I'm trying to think of, I think they did Wait Until Spring, Bandini, and they did the one about Henry Miller, and they tried to do Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and none of them were any good.
Yeah.
And maybe there's something about film, it's such a different medium from literature, where everything's happening in your head, and I don't know.
I don't know. I think the scenes are there. I think if you look at On the Road, you can find amazing scenes of spirituality that are visual, that can be filmed. You know, you can have the clouds, and suddenly you see a finger in the clouds. But they didn't want any of that. They just had it in their minds that this is a movie about sex, a book about sex and drugs, which it's not.
That's
they were
sad.
Coming at it from the absolute wrong angle. You know? And of course that's been part of the big misunderstanding about Kerouac all along.
It's about he's a spiritual seeker. It's almost like the Hermann Hesse, The Journey to the East or something. This was his journey to the West.
Well, he's a spiritual seeker in real American terms. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he tried the sitting in yoga position and all that, and it didn't work for him. I mean, he began to see that you had to find spirituality, you know, on the roads of America, you know, riding in the old jalopy and meeting the people that you're going to meet on the road, and that's where the spiritual Satori awakening comes. You know, too much of this, you've had people like, you know, Naropa Institute, where you're adopting Hinduism or Tibetan Buddhism, and you're trying to follow the precepts of some other culture. And when Jack felt that, Jack was a spiritual person, but he felt the spirituality was, you meet an old bum, you know, in the beginning of the Dharma Bums, which was a book that blew me away when I first read Kerouac. He meets an old bum on the railroad car, and he gives the bum some cheese to eat, and the bum gives him a prayer from St. Teresa. And then he goes down to the beach, and he gets off the train, the boxcar, and goes and cooks his supper, hot dogs in the sand of the Santa Barbara, where the ocean is crashing on the beach, nighttime, looks up at the stars, starts reading the poem, or the prayer to St. Teresa, and looks at the stars and says, "Who are they, and who am I? And why are they up there, and why am I down here?" And it's an incredible scene of American spirituality. It's not spirituality that you have to be sitting in yoga position, meditating like Ginsberg for 3 hours. It's American spirituality. Looking at, you know, the bum gave him the prayer on the boxcar, and he's now looking at the stars in Santa Barbara, and he's getting the greatest enlightenment that he could get.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the greatness about Kerouac, because he understands all these, you know, Asian traditions, European traditions, but he brings it all into America, into our, you know, the kind of lifestyle that you and I live every day.
I love the scene, the whole mountain climbing sequence is just so great. And I remember there's something that really struck me about that.
We should mention we're doing this interview like about 1 mile from where most of the Dharma bums took place.
More like a quarter mile. It's just like right over there. I could see it if there weren't these big trees all in the way. I walked by there today and saw Maverick's house. What was I going to say? Oh, but there was one scene in that book that I love so much that's really stayed with me, or just was that they're climbing the mountain and they're like halfway up. And I can't remember if it was Jack or if it was his friend remembered like, oh, no, I forgot to drain the oil out of the car.
Yeah, it was John Montgomery. I knew him well.
John Montgomery. And he's like, okay, go back. But there was something about, he was just like, all right, that's cool. I mean, there was just something about the warm-heartedness of that.
Oh,
it seemed like it could have been a disaster. Right, it could
they
be acceptance.
Accept him. He was a total he was a madman. I knew him very well. He lived in Marin, too. He lived all over Marin. He used to buy and sell houses, rebuild them all the time. He's a total madman.
Uh-huh.
Stayed up all night typing letters to people all over the world, John Montgomery. he talked just the way Jack caught his talk. It was this nonsense. He was a librarian, and he had like a million facts in his head. And he talked in a monotone, and they were totally disconnected. You know, and there were 35 million people who voted for Truman. And did you know that Hedy Lamarr went topless in her first movie? And he would just go on. There'd be no segues at all. And then be this one monotone, you know, and it was like endless facts. And you read the Dharma Bums,
he seemed
caught
like he could
it
be
exactly.
This,
he yeah, caught they, it exactly. Yeah. But yeah, they accepted him. That was part of what the Beat ethos was it was accepting everybody.
Right.
You know, you didn't have to be afraid. You're not handsome enough. You're not smart enough. You're not this enough. You're not that enough. You know, whoever you are, there's a place for you at the table. And that was the beautiful thing about the Beat Generation.
Yeah. And again, that's what struck me. It was when I reread that book a few years ago, was going on that passage and just, again, like the good-spiritedness, the warm-heartedness that I think is just really why I love Kerouac.
Compassion, enormous
compassion,
yeah.
Empathy, yeah. Very few writers get to that level. But so you are one of the world's preeminent Kerouac scholars.
Probably the preeminent,
if
they ever were
the,
honest about
right,
it.
Yeah, if not the guy. I mean, I read Memory Babe, in the early 90s, somebody gave me a copy, and I'm not going to go quite so far as to say it changed my life, but it had a big effect on me and my relationship to writing. And so thank you for that.
You're welcome.
But how did you get started? Let's go back. When did you discover Kerouac, and what is it that made you want to devote so much of your time and energy to the studies? Because, I mean, how many years did it take you to write that book? Like 10 years or something like that?
No, it was 6 years. And two of those years were fighting with publishers who were trying to change the book. I wrote faster in those days. I was younger. You know, I was 27 when I started work on the book. I traveled over 50,000 miles all over the country, all over Canada and the U.S. So one day I did 7 interviews in one day. That was my high point. But
that's exhausting.
I couldn't,
I'm tired just hearing
I
that.
Couldn't. And they weren't all in one place. It wasn't like 7 people filing in and out of my studio. I was like, you know, racing all over Manhattan to find people. But I'm going to be 70 years old on November 18th. So, you know, the energy is not what it used to be by a long shot, but I certainly had a lot more energy in those days. But, how did I get started? I always wanted to write. I loved writing since I was a kid. I remember talking with Gregory Corso once, and I told him, I said, I started writing when I was 8, and he said, I did too.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking with each other. We both had started writing at 8 years old. And so I was getting my master's degree in English and American Literature at the University of Illinois in Chicago.
Is that where you grew up, Chicago?
I grew up in Chicago, just outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Went to school in Chicago. Nobody was teaching, they didn't teach Kerouac in any American Literature courses there, and anywhere in the country at that time, basically.
Right.
This was 1972, and I was a teaching assistant, and I shared an office with a hip kid from Harvard who was always razzing me that I hadn't read Kerouac and taunting me. And so I thought one day, well, I got to read Kerouac because I got to at least be able to answer this guy. And in those days, there were only two of his books in print. I mean, literally, really? On the Road and Dharma Bombs.
Wow.
And I didn't want to read the famous one, On the Road, so I thought I'll read the less famous one, the Dharma Bombs.
Is that really true in 72?
Yeah.
There's only two in print?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Because I thought he was still very widely read
Oh, no. Well, in the 60s, yeah, but it was, again, mostly the Dharma Bums and On the Road.
Uh-huh.
I mean, people weren't reading Visions of Cody in the 60s.
Right.
They weren't reading The Subterraneans in the 60s.
Right.
Those two books were well known in the 60s, and those books stayed in print all the time.
Yeah.
But no, he was basically... I mean, I ended up having to send to England for his books. When I discovered him, and I discovered how much I loved him, I had to mail to England. I was ordering all of his, because his books were in print in England. They all stayed in print there.
Yeah.
They were all in print in France. They were out of print in this country. He died in eclipse. You know, when he died, he had $91 in the bank.
Mm.
His books were not selling at all.
Mm.
But like Fitzgerald, same thing. Died in at the low point of his career. But anyway, I when I read the Dharma Bums, it blew me away because, you know, my father was a Sicilian socialist. He was just barely born here. His parents had just come over from Sicily. His father was killed when he was 5 years old. My father grew up on the streets of Chicago, was totally self-educated, read enormously, loved Jack London, became a socialist because of Jack London.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, my father used to read to me from Jack London, from The Iron Heel, which is one of the great books about the oppression of the poor by the rich.
Yeah.
And so I was, and of course, Jack London was this great wanderer, too, hitchhiking across the country. And
also spent a lot of time right around here, too.
Yeah, and wrote about hobos and bums and things like that. And so when I read Kerouac, it was like, my God, this was ringing all these bells in my head. This is like Jack London. And the compassion for the poor. Because at that time, you know, the people that they were teaching in these courses at the University of Illinois or probably any university, they were teaching, you know, Saul Bellow and Philip Roth and John Updike, you know, people that are writing about the upper middle class. They're writing about the adulteries of the upper middle class. And nobody's writing about the hobos and the junkies and the prostitutes and the homeless. And I'm thinking here, he's writing about the lower class, the people on the wrong side of American capitalism. And he's writing about them not in a sociological way, but he's writing about them with deep compassion and heart and as if he really feels for them and feels their pain and wants them to be happy and wants them to suffer less. And I just thought, this is really extraordinary. And I would then bring him up to my professors and say, why is no one teaching Jack Kerouac? And they had the nastiest put-downs for him.
Mm-hmm.
He's not even a writer. He was a leader of beatniks. He was a sociological phenomenon. And one guy said to me, one professor said to me, he was a vortex. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? He said, well, a vortex, it's empty. There's nothing at the center, but it's valuable because it draws things into it. He drew people in. So that was Kerouac's role, drawing people in. But there was nothing in the middle. He himself was nothing. And it really enraged me. It really enraged me. I thought someday I'm going to write a book to prove to these people what a great writer he is. And as I said, I started sending to England for his books. And then I discovered that, you know, with the Dharma Bums, he was an innovator in content. I mean, because he was writing about areas of American life that nobody else was touching, except maybe Nelson Algren, who I hadn't read at that time, who I'm ashamed to say, because I'm from Chicago. And Nelson Algren, of course, was writing about the lower classes and the junkies.
Maybe
and
Bukowski.
And, well, Bukowski, not yet, no, not in the 50s. Bukowski,
not in the 50s, no.
Yeah,
no. Yeah, but in the 70s.
Well, we're talking about the 50s.
Yeah,
who was writing about this stuff in the 50s?
Yeah.
Nelson Algren was with The Man with the Golden Arm.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, nobody was writing about the lower classes and stuff. I mean, Bukowski was barely getting known. By the time I was in graduate school, Bukowski had an underground reputation. I mean, really hip people in 72 knew about Bukowski, but he was not anywhere near as widely known as he is right now.
Right, of course. Yeah.
So, I mean, so as far as I was concerned, like, this is the only guy I know that's even writing about the underclasses in this kind of, you know, embracing way. When I read these other books, like The Subterraneans and Visions of Cody, it was like there was this whole stylistic thing that I had never seen before, where he was trying to take bebop jazz and transfer it into prose, you know, long sentences, long breath sentences, riffing, like the breath going on and on. And this was amazing to me because he was a stylistic innovator as well as a content innovator. And you have to understand, in literature, if you're one or the other, you're great. You know, I mean, Dreiser had a horrible style, but he's considered a great writer because he was writing about prostitution and inequalities of wealth and poverty in 1900, Sister Carrie. Mm-hmm. But his style is horrible. I mean, it's clunky as hell. It really is. But he's still considered a great writer. But if you're just a stylistic innovator, you're considered great. If you just have a great style. But here you have a guy that's innovating style, bringing jazz into this, a whole new jazz style, and innovating content at the same time. You have to compare him to Shakespeare. I mean, that's what Shakespeare was all about. The language is there and the amazing content is there. And so then I was just really furious that these professors, you know, they couldn't see it, they couldn't hear it. And of course, you know, the whole thing of jazz, it's so foreign to a lot of these English departments. They can't even conceive of how, you know, jazz being something that you're writing. So I decided someday if I got a chance, I was going to write a book and show these people. And I had no money. I was a substitute. I could have gone on for my PhD. I had a 4-year fellowship awarded to me from UCLA, and I threw it away. My professors just, you know, they pulled their hair out. They couldn't believe it because nobody throws away a 4-year fellowship to UCLA. But I was so tired of playing the game at that point because I found out that, you know, it was very easy. I was bright. It was very easy for me to get A's by just, you fed back to the professor what he wanted to hear.
Right.
You know, if you gave him what he wanted, you got an A. But I knew that what they wanted to hear, they didn't, at that point in academia, they thought the beats were shit. Mm-hmm. And they did not, I mean, there was no way that I was going to be able to do a graduate thesis, a doctoral thesis on how great writer Kerouac was in 1972. I mean, no, never would have happened. If I even dared to write about the Beats, I would have had to show, you know, all the things that were wrong with them and how they were flawed as writers. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to do it. I mean, so I just said, here, take your 4-year fellowship back. I'm going to write this book on my own somehow. And I started working as a substitute teacher and trying to be a freelance writer. Which was not an easy road to hoe. And at some point I met Carl Mackey, who is a crazy man who lives in Fairfax now, fellow Chicagoan. And his father had quite a bit of money from the Curtis Candy Company. And he was financing Carl. Carl was going to do this enormously avant-garde magazine. Called X Magazine, and he had content from things from Henry Miller and things from Tim Leary, and Carol just did everything, but he didn't print the magazine. And his story is a subject for another interview, maybe, or maybe you should interview Carl. But he was an amazing guy and extremely brilliant, probably genius IQ. And he at one point he just said to me, "What would you really like to do for this magazine?" And I said, well, I'd really like to write a biography of Kerouac, but I don't know how you can do that in a magazine. He said, don't worry, we'll serialize it in the magazine.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And he gave me my first check to go to New York. But I got in on the tail end of things because this magazine was really kind of a lifestyle. There were many, many people living off this magazine. I mean, Carl had rented suites at the Bolorado Hotel.
That's a valid way to spend your candy money in here.
There's probably a novel in it because, I mean, Carl had rented suites at the Bolorado Hotel, which, if you know it, is really this beautiful old Gold Rush Hotel in Boulder. Have you ever been to Boulder?
I've never been to Boulder.
Well, that's where the Naropa Institute is, and that's where Ginsberg and all the Beats were teaching.
I somehow missed out on all. I've known a million people who've been there.
All of these street people, street poets, Jack Michelin had a suite there, and all these street poets, you know, had suites at the Bolorado courtesy of Carl and Carl's father's money, but this went on for 3 or so years, and then his father just cut off the money and said, "There's no magazine. That's the end of it." But I got in at the very end of it, so I got the ticket to New York, and that was all I ever got.
Mm.
But once I got to New York, I got to Northport, Long Island, and I started. I met Stanley Twardowicz, who was an abstract artist who was a close friend of Kerouac's. There, an amazing man, and. He showed me Kerouac's pants and coat were hanging on the wall, and the paintings Kerouac had done were in the corner. And I found out that Kerouac would hang out not with the writers and the intellectuals, but he'd go out and hang out with the fishermen and the clammers. And so Stanley says, Stasiu, you know, Polish guy, said, well, let's go out and talk to some of the clammers and some of the fishermen. We went out, and my God, I was getting these interviews you couldn't believe. I mean, stuff that nobody knew about Kerouac, you know. And so when Carl said, sorry, there's no more money, I said, I just have to continue this thing. This is, I had, one thing I had done is spent money and bought a really good Sony tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that went with me everywhere for 50,000 miles, but I kept going. I ended up hitchhiking and riding Greyhound buses and sleeping on people's floors. And eventually I got a little grant money to keep going. And I ended up interviewing over 300 people all over the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah. And most of his people were still alive back
then. They were
then
mostly
too.
Still alive, except for Neil Cassady. Everybody in Kerouac himself, everybody was still alive.
It's funny. I was just talking with somebody yesterday, this came up, but I started college in 1978, and for whatever reason, it's very funny. There's a very parallel conversation, and she's a New York poet, and she was telling me about how nobody cared about the Beats in the mid-70s, and for some reason, by the end of the 70s, so my first year in college, and I took some English survey course, taught us Corso and Ginsberg, and everybody was reading Naked Lunch. It's kind of interesting.
Where were you in college?
I went to Brown.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a little bit of an avant-garde school, though.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't happening generally at that time. Because one of the stories I tell in my new book, and I hope at some point we're going to mention my new book,
absolutely,
Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. This is one of the stories I tell at the very beginning. Is that in 1979, I had already been on the road for 2 years, and word had gotten out about me that there was this crazy guy going all over the country with a Sony tape recorder recording hundreds of people who knew Kerouac. And so We Magazine called me up, and We Magazine was a spinoff of Playboy. You may never have even seen it or heard of it. I don't know.
I was at the perfect age group to remember.
You remember We Magazine? It was supposed to be like the sophisticated French something, you know, French infected Playboy or something, or whatever.
Remember it fondly.
Well, they called me up and they said, "We want you to do an article about, you know, we've heard about you. We want you to do an article about the revival of Kerouac." I said, "Oh, this is great."
And those guys had tons of money back
They had
then,
a lot
too.
Of money. Oh, yeah. It was Playboy magazine, Hugh Hefner, which was going strong. You know, later on, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, Playboy has tailed off as a magazine. Yeah. But in those days, Playboy was at its height, 1979.
The circulation in the millions, probably.
But then, as I was about to begin work on it, they gave me this little stinger, and they said, but you know, because of our demographic, we're aiming at, like, college age or just out of college. We want you to write about where Kerouac's being taught in colleges as part of the main part of your story on the revival. And then I started, you know, making all these, because I had money for phone calls and everything, and I wasn't able to find any. I mean, it was Naropa Institute because Ginsberg had founded it.
And when did Naropa start? Like 75?
In 74. 74.
Okay.
There was actually a guy at Kent State in Ohio that was a big Beat guy, and he was teaching a course. But I ended up finding like maybe three courses in the whole country, and everywhere else there was nobody was teaching. And in England somebody was teaching it, but not here. And when I reported this to We Magazine, it was like, "Well, sorry, but you don't have a story. They gave me a kill fee. I actually made a decent kill fee, but there was no story because he wasn't being taught in 1979. It just wasn't. It might be one or two courses. I mean, there was a poet named George Dowden who was a friend of mine, an expatriate, went to India and then died in England, Brighton, England. Wonderful poet. Most people don't even know him, Kaviraj George Dowden. I did a big article. You can find it on Google. But he was a really hip guy and was a teaching assistant at NYU in 1959. And he was probably the first person in America. He actually was teaching Ginsberg and Burroughs and Kerouac to his entry-level students at NYU in 1959. But there were those rare things. Here and there you'd have a hip guy that was able to introduce the Beats into maybe a low-level course that he was teaching, you know, a guy that's working on his PhD or something, which I think George was at that time, some kind of graduate student. But, I mean, if you went out looking for actual courses, you'd have a really hard time finding them. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess they were always just dismissed both by the highbrow literary community and academia.
Well, I mean, if you've read the reviews of Kerouac, you know, everybody knows the initial review, which is what made him, which was by Gilbert Milstein in the New York Times. And the only reason that review happened is that the actual reviewer, the main Sunday reviewer, was on vacation, and so they gave the book to Gilbert Milstein, who I think was a jazz critic or something. That wasn't his main thing, and he wrote that great review that this is like the sun also rises for the 50s. You know, this man is named a whole generation, and it was an amazing review that put Kerouac on the map, and all the TV shows wanted him. But after that review. All the reviews that followed for a decade were extremely negative. I mean, they called him a black spot on America, a sponsor of juvenile delinquency. Mm. I mean, you can go down the list of the horrible names that they called this man. He was, you know, one guy wrote that he was sponsoring teenage murders. I mean, they saw the Beats as criminals. And you know, this was a time, the late 50s and early 60s. I mean, there was still a lot of paranoia about drugs and homosexual, well, bisexuality.
Some of them were criminals, too.
Well, yeah. Yeah, and the whole thing about Kerouac, that he was looking at criminals as beautiful, people. As angels, as beautiful human beings with human dignity.
Yeah.
This just really offended people. Now, Norman Podhoretz, who was the dean of critics in New York, one of the reasons Kerouac, I think, became as anti-Semitic as he was, you know, he felt that Podhoretz obviously was Jewish, and Kerouac felt there was this Jewish New York conspiracy against him. Yeah. But Podhoretz was extremely square guy. I mean, you know, moral straight arrow. And it just deeply offended Podhoretz that he's writing about car thieves and adulterers and drug users, drug addicts, and writing about them in a praiseworthy way. I mean,
The other guy, Lionel Trilling?
Trilling was he wasn't quite as bad. He just didn't understand the Beats. He was one of their professors at Columbia, but I mean, you know, he didn't get what the hell they're doing. It's like, what if they took a wrong turn after they got out of his classes or something? Yeah. But Podhoretz was morally offended that he felt these people were going to bring down American society. It was kind of like a Trump of literature. He was saying, you know, these people can bring down society if we don't stop them.
Communist thought.
So the Beats were enemies of the people, according to the press and the government. And J. Edgar Hoover said that the head of the FBI said the Beats were one of the three greatest threats to America. After the communists and the eggheads, then he listed the Beats as the third. The eggheads, like Adlai Stevenson, I guess, because they were sort of communist pinko sympathizers, you know. Seriously, and and Kerouac was followed all over the place by agents. He was constantly being, followed by FBI agents and stuff. These people were, you know, the Beats were being seriously harassed, and then there was this whole campaign to shut the coffee houses down, because the coffee houses have been the center of Beat writing and reading of work and stuff. And around 1960, they came up with all these ordinances, fire ordinances, whatever they could. They just came and shut down all the coffee houses in New York and San Francisco.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And Bob Kaufman in San Francisco was beaten by the police. And, of course, he had put a poem in the window of the bagel shop saying, there was this really bigoted officer, Officer Bigarini, who could not stand the fact that Bob Kaufman had a white wife with a black poet. Black Jewish poet with a white wife, and Bob put a poem in the window that Officer Bigarini was Hitler, you know, reincarnated or something. And of course, that didn't go over too well with Officer Bigarini. But they grabbed Kaufman off the streets, you know, with his bare feet and his sandals, and locked him in an elevator at the police station and beat the hell out of him, broke his feet and everything else. And you know, and by the time the elevator opened, Bob was ready to go to the hospital. It was pretty heavy duty oppression, and so all of that affected the fact that Kerouac's works went out of print very quickly, and that he died with $91 in the bank.
Yeah,
which is a little bit about what my new book is about how he died in poverty and how now his estate is generating millions and millions of dollars, but not for his real family.
So, what do you think the change was? Because I mean, as it always is with kids, it seemed to me, like I said, I was getting exposed to that stuff in college, and it just seemed like, I guess everybody gets exposed to this stuff. And obviously that's not true. Maybe, who knows, maybe it was the first year where they were teaching that
stuff.
What
year was this?
78.
That was early.
Yeah. So when do you think, what caused the sea change whereby
very
different by like 1990.
Excuse me. I don't know what's going on with me here. It was a gradual thing. I mean, you know, Ion Chargers wrote the first biography, which was 74, I guess. The next biography was I think Jack's book, the oral biography by Larry Lee and Barry Gifford.
Mm-hmm. Is that the same Barry Gifford from
he's a
Black
big time,
Lizard books?
Was active in publishing noir mysteries, and that's one of the ways he made his reputation. And then he started writing film scripts, and he's become a big-time Hollywood writer now. Mm-hmm. He had a big movie, and I forget what it was called, but he's a script writer now and does quite well for himself. But that was the same Barry Gifford. And Larry Lee, who was a journalist who was one of the first people to die of AIDS in San Francisco, one of the first notable people to die of AIDS. But they did a very good oral biography called Jack's Book. And then Dennis McNally's biography, which was it was really his history thesis when he was at Amherst, and it was really focused, I think, on the history and the political changes that the Beat Generation brought.
So
and that was like 81 or
Dennis
something.
Dennis McNally, you became the
PR yeah.
guy.
All these people ended up with great careers except me. I'm still a hobo of some sort. But Dennis McNally became the spokesman for the Grateful Dead, and they did very well for himself. But so he wrote a book, came out in 81, Desolate Angel. My book, which I like to think did something, because my book was the first, and I think still is the only critical biography, Memory Babe. That is, that I look at all of his books and I analyze all of his books and look at exactly what which I told those professors I was going to do years before. I'm going to show you what this guy accomplished.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I go through his books one by one and I show what the literary innovations are in each one, as well as telling his life story. And when my book came out, actually, the reviews were kind of schizophrenic, because the book got enormously good reviews in terms of coverage. It was on the front page of the Washington Post and the front page of the Los Angeles Times and the front page of the Chicago Tribune. In those days, all these papers had big book reviews, which they don't anymore. But the reviewers all said, well, this is incredible. Mr. Nicosia has done fantastic biographical research. He has traced, Kerouac's life moment by moment. But then when they got to the part of my book where I'm saying that Kerouac was the equivalent of Joyce and Proust and Dostoevsky, they would say, but the only problem with Mr. Nicosia is he has these crazy ideas that Kerouac was a great writer.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't swallow that part of the book, and which is my had the last laugh, because of course now Kerouac is considered one of the great pioneer writers of America. But at that time, they liked the biographical story I told, but they thought I was crazy. I mean, they literally said I was crazy for thinking that Kerouac was as great as Proust or Dostoevsky, which I think he is. That was 1983. They still weren't ready to look at him as a great writer. They were starting to look at him as a cultural figure in 1983, but they still were not. They were nowhere near ready to swallow him as a great writer.
Yeah.
But you had a lot of things going on in the 80s. You had two biographical films, John Antonelli, who was from Mill Valley, or lived in Mill Valley, and the guys down in L.A. who did Whatever Happened to Kerouac, two very good biographical films. You had a number of conferences. There was in Plymouth, England, there was a big Beat conference. There was a big Beat conference. Notably, a lot of this outside of America, if you'll listen, in Quebec City, big Beat conference, Kerouac conference. And then eventually in 94, well, now we're jumping a little bit, 94, 95, you had the two big conferences back-to-back at NYU. But it was, so the academic conferences, the cultural conference, I mean, all this stuff was going on. Rhino Records in 1990 reissued all of Kerouac's recordings so people could hear his voice again, which are amazing, because you can then hear the jazz style. When you listen to Kerouac reading, you can hear the importance of jazz. And the reissue of those early recordings only sold a few hundred copies and went out of print very quickly. But when Rhino Records released them, it was a big event. I was in Hollywood there. It was 1,000 people showed up for the party to release those records. And then again, the conferences in the 90s. And then when Stella died, that was a big, and this again, we're getting a little bit into my book, is Stella was not allowing anybody to talk about Kerouac. She wouldn't talk to anybody. She wouldn't let any of his unpublished works be published. So Stella, and now we know, because there was a forgery. Stella or someone of the Sampuses forged Jack's mother's will, and that's why the Sampus family ended up with Kerouac's estate. But it appears now that the reason Stella was keeping everything locked up was, she was afraid. She was implicated in a forgery, and she didn't want people to see it. And so,
right, you talked about that in your new book, but about how she was very open at first.
She was. She welcomed Barry Gifford. She welcomed a guy named Marshall Clemens, who was a Kerouac collector. In those days, she would let anybody come in and talk about Kerouac. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, after 1973, which is when the will was forged and Gabrielle died, Jack's mother, and the will was filed, she suddenly clammed up, began slamming the phone down on people, wouldn't talk to anybody. And that put a damper on Kerouac scholarship for, well, almost two decades, because she didn't die till 1990. But once she died, then her family, led by her brother John Sampas, decided they wanted to make as much money as possible. And so they began releasing stuff, which was good in some ways. I mean, I'm glad that stuff became public, although the problem is that there was a lot of censorship. I mean, John Sampas would go over manuscripts, and if he didn't like something that was in there, he would take it out.
Right.
In the publication of Kerouac's letters, there were something like 400 deletions of parts of his letters, and 200 of those deletions were not even marked. 200 times you see dot, dot, dot. You see the ellipsis. And then there were another 200 deletions where it's not even marked. You don't even know that something was taken out. And many times what was taken out was the dark side of Kerouac, because suddenly Kerouac was a product. He was a marketable product.
Right, and he was also like this macho guy and all, you know.
Well, they wanted to highlight the handsome hero, the Lothario, the vagabond, the happy vagabond. They did not want to talk about the paranoid, the anti-Semitic person, the misogynistic person who had many feelings of hatred and fear of women. To them, that was going to be, that was going to depreciate the value of the product. I mean,
and that's why they didn't like your book, because you talked about his
well, yeah, I talked about his bisexuality. I also talked about the fact that he was trying to divorce Stella when he died. That marriage was not a happy marriage.
Mm-hmm. They were only married for a short time.
3 years. He married her to take care of his mother.
I didn't even know it was that long. I thought it was even shorter than that.
No, it was 3 years. His mother had a stroke in 1966, and his mother would refuse to go into a nursing home. And Jack Kerouac, there was only one woman in his life, and that was his mother, that he had any real strong emotional connection with. Mm-hmm. His mother dominated him. She played him back and forth. I mean, she would praise him in ways and tell him he was a great writer, and then she would undercut him and tell him, but you know, your brother Gerard, he had a brother who died in boyhood of rheumatic fever, who the nuns in Lowell said was a saint. And his mother would say, but you're not the saint your brother was. You know, you're out there with women and you're out there drinking. You know, you're disgracing your brother. And he'd have his head down and he'd be sobbing. And then she'd say, but you know, Jackie, I know you're a genius. I love you. And she played him back and forth like that between the condemnation and the praise. And she had him. I mean, he just could never get away from her. And when she had the stroke and was paralyzed, she said, I'm not going into a nursing home. You're taking care of me. Now, this is the king of the beats. This is a guy that, you know, his lifestyle is you go out on two-week binges, drinking, hellcatting, then you come home and write for a week because you got all this material. But you don't sit down from 9 to 5 every day and write. You know, that's not the way he worked. And there was no way he could take care of a paralyzed mother, bedpans, and all that stuff. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he desperately, as I found out later, went around to all of his relatives, including Dora, his cousin Harvey and his wife, Doris. They were very close. They lived nearby.
And he grew up with the Sampas family in Lowell, right?
Well, I'm saying, but first he went to the Kerouac family. He went to the Kerouacs. He asked Doris Kerouac, who was taking care of three old women and she had three kids and his great aunt. And she said, she later told me all this. Doris said, I told Jack, I can't take care of your mother. I got a full house here. He couldn't find anybody, and finally his last thought was Stella Sampas. He loved Sammy Sampas, was his boyhood friend, was the first poet he knew in Lowell, the first kid who gave him, a Greek kid, probably gay, loved Jack. I think, I've read the letters, I think he was probably in love with Jack, but it was a very close relationship. It made Jack very uneasy, because Jack was very uneasy with his own bisexuality. In fact, if you read the letters between them, you'll see Sammy saying, I love you, Jack, and you see Jack saying, now cool it, Sammy, cool it, we're good friends, you know. But anyway, he did love Sammy, and Sammy, the main thing that Sammy did for him was he gave Jack the courage to be a writer and a poet in a rough working class mill town, where if you were a writer or a poet, they called you a fag, and they ridiculed you were a sissy and a fag, and most people, if they wrote poetry, would keep it densely hidden. And Lowell was a rough town. Whereas Sammy would jump up on the tables of the cafe and as if he were Shelley and declaiming the poetry and really gave Jack the guts to be a poet and be a writer. So he loved Sammy. And Sammy died in World War II. And Sammy had an older spinster sister, never been married. Her job was taking care of her father and her mother. And, you know, one of the things the Sampses didn't like was, I revealed in my book, was that the Sampas father had gone to prison for murder. He killed somebody in a Greek dice game.
Oh, wow.
And the Sampas father had gone to prison for 30 years, and I revealed that in my book, and they were absolutely furious that I revealed that. Anyway, he went to Stella Sampas, and he said, "Will you take care of my mother?" And Stella said, "Well, you know, Jackie, I'm a good Greek girl, and if you want me to live in your house, you're going to have to marry me."
Mm.
And he said, "Okay, I'll marry you." Mm-hmm. He married her literally to take care of his mother, which I think is about the stupidest reason to get married that you can have. And it didn't work out because again, she was a very small town Greek girl. You know, her English was very bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she could barely speak English. And her concept of a writer was all she had seen in the movies. You know, a guy wears a tweed suit and smokes a pipe, and he gets up in the morning, 9 to 5, he types, and then, you know, he's done and goes to supper. And she couldn't, and there's Jack going out and getting drunk every night, and she was, "No, you can't do that, Jackie, you're not writing." Well, of course, he was getting material. I mean, as I said, his thing was getting the binges, and then you come home and write, lock yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
But they were living in Lowell, where she had all these brothers, and they ran the bars, and they ran the, you know, they ran the minor vice in Lowell. That's not a secret, okay? In fact, it's a well-known fact. It's been written about that her brother Tony was one of the biggest bookies in Lowell.
Mm-hmm.
And Nikki's Bar was a center for bookie operations, prostitution, bottomless dancing. I was there. I spent 3 months there. I know what went on in Nikki's Bar. I saw it firsthand. These guys were tough guys, these brothers. Mm-hmm. And so she would send them out to catch him. He'd go out drinking, and the two brothers would come and grab him and throw him in the car and bring him home.
So where were they living at this time? Were they in Florida?
In Lowell,
already?
No. Oh, no, they were in Lowell, Massachusetts. Okay. That's her hometown and his hometown. And he knew the marriage wasn't working. And then they moved to Florida. And she was still trying to control him, and he'd still go out on binges.
Did he move to Florida to get away from the brother and the rest of the family?
Well, maybe. But he also moved to Florida because his mother wanted a warmer climate.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the mother was dominating him, too.
Same
but
anyone else moves
but
to Florida.
But the marriage, you know, he needed to get out. And he'd gone to his lawyer to initiate divorce proceedings, but he never lived long enough for it to happen. And he did change his will and left everything to his mother and said in a letter that he wanted, the last letter he wrote the day before he died, that if his mother died, he wanted his nephew, his sister's son. His sister died fairly young too, T. Nin, Carolyn. He wanted her son. She had one child, Paul Blake Jr., who I knew very well, wonderful, lovely guy who died last December. He has a son and a big family, and there's a family of that. Paul Blake III has children, and they're all living in a trailer. They're living in great poverty in Arizona. They got nothing because of this forged will.
Right. So now we're getting into
my book.
Yeah,
because my concern, one of my big concerns, well, I have two big concerns in that book. One is the way that the Sampas family has skewed Kerouac's scholarship by only issuing books that have been censored, you know, the parts cut out, and also controlling who can look at materials and what they can write about Kerouac.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually they sold, first of all, they broke up Kerouac's archive in an unconscionable way by selling it off.
That seemed like a tragedy, just selling everything off piecemeal to get the highest price for it rather than putting it in one place where scholars could.
The heart of Kerouac's archive are those 9 roll manuscripts. 9 of his books were written on these long rolls of paper. This was his great innovation, because he was a speed typist and he wanted to get the bebop, unconscious, nonstop flow. And of course, today it's something we wouldn't even think about
computer,
it, because now you just sit at the computer. You don't have to. But in those days, you had to change the paper every 11 inches, and that totally broke the flow.
Right,
you know, he couldn't
get
the flow. And so by feeding these long rolls of paper into the typewriter, he could suddenly type for 3 or 4 or 5 hours without even having to stop to change the paper. So there's 9 books that were written on those rolls of paper. Dharma Bums, On the Road, Big Sur. There was the Vanity of Duluaz. There was even Desolation Angels. There was even, somebody even told me that he did, because he did write the poems, Mexico City Blues, in a notebook, but then he retyped mm-hmm. those. I had several witnesses who told me that he retyped those. There was a roll of Mexico City Blues. All those rolls are in private hands. Not one of them right. is in the Berg collection, because I asked Isaac Gewurz, who is the curator of the Berg, and I said, what rolls do you have? And he started out very defensively. He said, well, I have 4 feet of the Dharma Bums, and I have 2 feet of Desolation Angels. And I said, no, those are the tear-offs. Because the way Kerouac would work, he had to get into a sort of a trance state to work. Mm-hmm. He said it's like opening the faucet and waiting for the water to run cold. He would get as high as he could. He'd put Bach on, or he'd put bebop on, and he'd start typing this super 110 words a minute, super fast. But the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it hadn't hit yet. The magic had not mm-hmm. hit yet. And he would tear those off. I literally saw some of those. One landed behind the radiator of somebody bought his house in Northport and found one of these 4 foot strips. If he felt like, I haven't gotten it yet, he'd just rip that thing off and throw mm-hmm. it, whatever, throw it behind the radiator. And at some point, though, he would feel it hit. And when the magic, the magic, whatever you want to call it, the subconscious flow finally hit, then the rest of it became the take, you know. Mm-hmm. So what Gewurz has, the curator of the Berg collection at the New York Public Library, he has some of these tear-offs. He's got 4 feet, 2 feet. He doesn't have one, because the actual rolls are about 120 feet each. He doesn't yeah. have one of those. All of those have been sold into private hands, yeah. and we don't even know where they are. The only one we know is Jim Irsay, because he was the owner of the right. Baltimore, used to be Baltimore, now it's Indianapolis Colts.
And I believe he also... is the guy who bought Jerry Garcia's guitars for like millions of dollars.
Well,
like
I know, and he's a little crazy, as everybody knows. And yeah. and by the way, he makes money on the roll manuscript. And by the way, Kerouac called it a roll. He never called it a scroll.
I thought in your book that was hilarious in a dark way, is that they actually put like it's a Torah or something. They actually
or Dead Sea. Well, they were compared when they were auctioning it. The word scroll was brought into yeah. the whole picture. Jack said that his roll manuscripts, he actually rolled them up like a roll of tar paper and carried them under his arm. And he said it's like the highway at night. These were those old 1950s two-lane highways with the white line in the middle. He says it's like driving at night on the narrow highway and you watch that white line unrolling in front of your headlights. That's what my writing is like. And I love that analogy of the highway mm-hmm. unrolling in front of your headlights. But when they went to auction it at Christie's in 2001, again, it was like me with the movie people. You know, they say they couldn't sell a spiritual movie. Well, these guys were saying, well, how much money are we going to get for a roll, you know, a tar paper roll, if we call it a scroll?
Right.
And in all of the marketing, they compared it to the, I saw it, they compared it to the Dead Sea Scrolls in the marketing. God. And that's how they got $2.5 million for it. And now, thanks to John Sampas publishing the scroll edition of On the Road, everybody uses the word scroll, and it drives me crazy because that was not Kerouac's word.
Yeah.
But, you know, now those roles are all in private hands. You can't study them. Jim Irsay makes money by sending that thing around. He doesn't send it around for free. Libraries have told me they have to pay in the tens of thousands of dollars to show that thing.
As if he doesn't have enough money already.
So, you know, because he sends it around, it's in a special glass case, and the guard, you have to pay for the guards that come with it. So it's a big production, and he's generating money off of it. And the thing is, you can't study it. I mean, right. at one point, you know, because it's full of little pencils.
Right. And they just roll out like 20 feet.
Yeah, 10 or 20 feet of it. And you can see all those little penciled corrections, but you can't write them down. When it was at Columbia College in Chicago, I went to lean on the glass case because I wanted to start writing down some of the corrections. And two guards came to me. One came and grabbed me, one on each arm, and lifted me off the case and said, sir, you are not permitted to lean on the glass of the case. So there is no way that you can actually study it or write down the changes the way it is now.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that the Sampases, eventually they put a bunch of stuff, not the roll manuscripts. They did put a bunch of notebooks. Not put, they sold a bunch of notebooks for what I've heard, millions of dollars, to the Berg collection. But they didn't sell them free and clear, which really bugs the hell out of me that the Berg collection, your library spends millions of dollars. You know, you buy a house for a couple of $1 million. Shouldn't you have it free and clear? You shouldn't have a provision that somebody's aunt has to come and live there 6 weeks a year. Mm. I mean, it's the same thing. When they bought that stuff at the Berg collection, the Sampas has put all these rules on it. People can only see it with our permission. If anybody writes about it, we have to approve what they write about it. So all that stuff is not free and clear. First of all, I'd have to get permission to go and look at the stuff, and then if I write something about it, I have to submit it to the Sampases. If I've used any of that material in what I'm writing, they get to go through it and change what I've written or edit it or complain something needs to be taken out. There is not free and clear Kerouac scholarship. And to my mind, that's a terrible situation. Yeah. That is certainly not going to, you know, enhance our understanding of Kerouac. So the scholarship is my one big concern in my new book. The other concern is his real family, because both of those ends of that real family, Jan Kerouac was a close friend of mine, and Paul Blake Jr. was a close friend of mine, Jack's sister's son. They were both very good people. I mean, you know, yes, they used drugs, they used alcohol, but they were fundamentally heartful people. They were the kind of people that would take care of you if you were sick and would give you their last hot dog if you were starving. Mm-hmm. That kind of good, you know, maybe not Catholic Church good or whatever, but good people, fundamentally kind people.
And they got screwed out of everything.
Both of them got screwed because of that forged will. They should have inherited an estate that was worth millions of dollars. Instead, Jan was washing dishes and working in corn canneries until well into the mid-1980s. Paul Blake Jr. was, you know, doing carpentry, hard work, and he just, you know, his life fell apart. But he had, in some ways, he had life even harder than Jan, because Jan always had her mother. You know, Jan didn't have a father there, but Joan Haverty, who could be eccentric too, but she and Jan had a buddy relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, whenever Jan was desperate, she could always go. Her mother might have a little shack in Kittitas, Washington, but Jan could always go home to it.
Yeah. And she had such a tragic life.
But Paul lost
too.
Everybody. I mean, okay, Paul's mother died when he was 16 years old. The situation there was his mother was Jack's sister, was a good Roman Catholic. Her husband leaves her for another woman, which, you know, in the Catholic Church, this is, you know, you can't get even get a, in those days, you couldn't even get a divorce in the Catholic Church. And her husband leaves her for another woman. She never got over it. She basically stopped eating, starved herself to death, died of a heart attack. She was down to 80 pounds. Mm. And he came home from high school one day at 16 years old and found his mother dead on the couch.
Oh, my God.
Then 2 years later, his uncle Jack, who he's also close to, dies. Then 2 years later, his own father, and then his father felt so much guilt about causing his wife's death, that his father, Paul's father, drank himself to death. So by the time Paul is like 20, and then Jack's mother, that's Gabrielle, she dies in 73. Within a space of 6 or 8 years, this kid loses his mother, his father, his dear uncle, and his dear grandmother.
Yeah.
So he was messed up. And at one point he started drinking too heavily, and at one point he had a psychotic breakdown. He started seeing the ghosts of all of his family coming, and they institutionalized him, and he was never quite the same. He'd go out and he'd work low-level jobs, and he ended up homeless several times. But, you know, had he gotten the inheritance he needed, and I mean, the whole thing of being cut off from his family was a big thing too, because he never understood why was I disinherited, why was I cut off from my grandmother, because his grandmother used to write him loving letters, and I saw those letters, my beautiful, my darling blonde grandson. I had Xeroxes of those letters in my archive in Lowell, Massachusetts, and they mysteriously disappeared. There was all kinds of stuff was stolen out of my archive in Lowell, and those were Xeroxes. They weren't worth any money, but somebody didn't want people to know how much, you know, grandmother Gabrielle loved her grandson Paul. Mm-hmm. But anyway, both of those kids had awfully hard lives, and they both yet were very decent people. And I really loved them as people.
Didn't Jack write, like, his last letter?
His
was
last
to
letter
Paul.
Was to Paul, saying, you know, if I'm giving this to my mother because she needs it, but I want, you know, if when she dies, I want you to take care of it for the sake of my bloodline. So both of the, you know, and it's too late for Jan. She's dead. But why aren't the Sampuses helping Paul Blake's family? I mean, Paul Blake died in December, but he has a son who's now 42 or 43, Paul Blake III. He's got kids. Two of his kids have health problems. Paul himself has got a bad back, can't work half the time. Why? And they're all living in a trailer in Arizona when this estate is now worth more than $30 million. Why are the Sampuses not helping them, buying them a house in Arizona with a little bit of that $30 million?
Yeah.
Paying some of the medical bills for the Blake family. This is Jack's direct blood family. This is the family of Jack Kerouac's sister, his beloved T. Nin, who he wrote about in his books. This is T. Nin's family.
Yeah. So what is the state of the lawsuit at this point? Is it over? Is it
the lawsuit was won for the Kerouac family. I mean, it was proven in court in 2009 that the will was forged. It was a very strong decision. The judge, George Greer, who was one of the toughest judges in Florida, he said in probate court you only need a preponderance of evidence, but if I was weighing this under criminal standards of beyond a reasonable doubt, I would still have found that this is a forgery because it's such an outrageous forgery. I mean, his decision is a tremendous, powerful decision. And then they took, the Sampasas took it to appeal, and on appeal in 2011, once again, it was upheld that this is a forgery. But Stella had died in 1990 before anybody knew about the forgery, because the will was still hidden at that time. Mm. In 1990, when Stella died, she was still in possession of all of these materials, and nobody knew there was a forgery, and Stella left everything in her will to her brothers and sisters, the Sampas family, John Sampas. And lo and behold, the Sampases, with their really expensive lawyers, discovered that there was an inheritance law in Florida that says you can keep anything you inherit in Florida. It's called a non-claim statute. You can keep anything you inherit, even stolen property. Somebody can leave you a stolen Mercedes-Benz. If nobody complains within 2 years, you keep whatever you've inherited.
Oh, man.
And so the Sampasas found this little law, and they said, well, look, Stella left us this stuff. Now, Stella's will is not in question here. You understand, Stella's got a perfectly legitimate will. Stella left us this stuff in 1990. Jan didn't complain till 1994. That's 4 years. The reason being, Jan never saw nobody saw that forged mm-hmm. will until 1994. So 4 years have elapsed. Under Florida law, after 2 years, we keep whatever we inherited. And so by that non-claim statute, they're keeping what is now in the books as a stolen estate. Mm. And that still gives them their power and all this other stuff. But you think maybe out of humanity or some sort of moral yeah. feeling, they would at least try to yeah. help.
So the legal recourse is done.
The legal recourse is gone, other than, there are things, there are little frayed edges of this. I don't know how much you want to get into this, but, you know, the Sampases have claimed publicity rights for Kerouac.
Right.
Which maybe for Joe Blow down the street, publicity rights mean absolutely nothing. But you have to understand, Jack Kerouac is on a par with James Dean or Marilyn Monroe as a cult figure.
Right.
Anything he touched is worth money, and also putting his face on anything or mm-hmm. his name on anything is worth a lot of money. So they have an agency in Indianapolis, a famous publicity rights agency, I forget what it's called, that there's anybody using Kerouac's name or image, they go after them for a percentage, for royalties. And there's lots and lots of money coming in, there's money coming in on copyright royalties, but there's also a lot of money coming in on this so-called publicity rights thing. Now, the interesting thing is that publicity rights are supposed to descend through the bloodline. They're supposed to descend to the closest blood relative. But the Sampases just claim stuff. I mean, they bluff all yeah. the time. They've said, oh, yeah, we also have the publicity rights. Well, that didn't go through Stella's will. The stuff that went through Stella's will is protected. Remember, there's that two-year thing. Nobody complained within 2 years. Whatever went through Stella's will, it's good. Okay, it's been transmuted to gold. But the publicity rights did not go through Stella's will. Theoretically, those should have gone to Paul Blake, because that's the closest living blood relative. I think, but Paul has no money. I mean, their family has no money. They can't pay their medical bills. But theoretically, yeah. I think they would have a very good case to say, we should be collecting all that publicity money, not the Sampases. Because yeah. that didn't come from Stella's will. That just came from, you know, normally those rights go to the blood relatives. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when they discovered the Joan Anderson letter, Neil Cassady's letter that inspired Kerouac, which had been hidden for 50 or 60 years, that didn't go through Stella's will either, because it wasn't even known at that time. Mm-hmm. So Paul's lawyers said, well, hey, and they ended up, the lawyers botched it. It was supposed to sell for $500,000, and then they botched that auction, and they ended up selling it for, I think, $150,000. And six people put in claims for it. The woman who found it in her father's garbage, and the Cassady family, and the Sampases, and Paul Blake's family. It was actually six people that put in claims on that. So the $150,000 was supposed to be divided by, you know, six ways, minus legal fees. But that was a little bit, you know, that one sixth share minus legal fees was going to come down to $10,000, was supposed to go to the Blake family, but the Sampases had blocked it. They've made motions wow. against it. And to the point right now, I call Paul Blake once a week or so, and he says, so far we haven't seen it, but we're hoping we're going to see that, you know, $10,000. They're hoping and praying they'll get to see it. But, you know, there are things like, if something shows up that did not go through Stella's will, theoretically, that Blake should get a part of it, at least a part of it, whatever, the, you know, theoretically they should get the whole Kerouac share of it. But then with the Cassidy letter, there were all these claims of people who discovered it, so forth. The other thing is that there's, you know, I talked to Mark Toberoff, who's a famous rights lawyer down in L.A., and he said that he thought if somebody had the money that they could challenge that non-claim statute in Florida, that it's really unconstitutional. You're not allowing people to keep stolen property. Mm-hmm. And but, you know, Toberoff, who's a big-time lawyer who gets, I don't know how many $1,000 an hour, he would need somebody to pay him to go down there and launch a case to challenge that law. So, I mean, there are all these sort of little possibilities. Yeah. But right now, the Sampuses control everything and are reaping in millions and millions of dollars and not helping Kerouac's family to the tune of anything.
Yeah. Well, I thought the book, Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century, was it was fascinating, and it was ultimately, to use one of Jack's favorite words, it was sad.
Hmm.
It was just very sad. And don't get me started about American capitalism and money. And they got their $30 million, and that's enough. But anyway,
it's not enough. They want more all the time.
They want more all the time. Nobody's ever satisfied. It's the hungry ghost sort of thing. But you are also a poet.
I'm a poet, yes.
Yeah. So would you like to read us some of your work? And is this going to be in a new collection?
I'm going to. I should mention Cool Grove Press in Brooklyn, which we are trying to raise now the money to issue a new, revised, and updated Memory Babe, my biography of Kerouac, which I did already do. I've already written and, you know, done the whole revision and updating, and it was supposed to have been published by a Berkeley press that backed out about a year and a half ago. And there's a press in Brooklyn now. If we can raise the money, it'll be published there. And they're also, Cool Grove will publish this fall a new book of my poetry called Beat Scrapbook, which is about all the people I've known in the beat world, famous and non-famous. And it's also a little bit about my own background and how I came to, you know, my beat view of the world. I have one poem about my father reading me from the Iron Heel when I was 10 years old and how that kind of formed this beat sensibility in me, so that when I came upon the beats, I was already primed for them, you know. I'll just read one poem from it. It's about 40 poems or so. So I was thinking of maybe reading, the first poem is to Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who just turned 100 years old. And it mentions Jan Kerouac in the poem, so that's nice too, because I love Jan very much. And her works, by the way, have been kept out of print. Her heirs, her half-brother, David Bower Stewart, and her ex-husband, John Lash, have been in league with the Sampas family. At the time when Jan died, she made me her literary executor to carry on the lawsuit. And obviously the Sampas family did not want the lawsuit carried on because they knew there was all this evidence that the will was forged. So the only way to get rid of me so that I couldn't carry on the lawsuit was to talk to her, to make a deal with her heirs. And her heirs made a deal with them. This is all part of the record, the legal record. I'm not making anything up here. Her heirs made a deal with the Sampases to get rid of me. I didn't want to. I said, my mission is from Jan Kerouac. I'm supposed to take care of her papers and her lawsuit. And so we fought for 3 years in Albuquerque, and finally they got me thrown out. They got a ruling in Albuquerque that the heirs can fire a literary executor, and so they fired me. Jan, because of Jan's heirs being in league with the Sampas family, the deal was confidential. We asked the court, we said, we want to know what the term, we want you to make these heirs reveal what the deal is with the Sampases. And the heirs came back and they said, it's a confidential deal. We don't have to reveal it. And this was one of those points of in the law they call judicial discretion. There are things in the law that are neither black nor white where the judge has the right to make a decision. In this case, the judge could have told the heirs, Bowers and Lash, okay, we want to know what the deal is. And the judge just said, okay, they say it's confidential. They don't have to reveal it. So we don't know, but I have had indications that deal didn't end in 1999 when I was thrown out as Jan's literary executor. I think that there are ramifications of that deal that are still in place. Because for one thing, her heirs have kept her books out of print. Jan's books, Baby Driver and Train Song, are now out of print. and her third novel, Parrot Fever, which I had tried to, I got a contract for while I was still her literary executive for 3 years. I got a contract with Thunder's Mouth Press, and her ex-husband, John Lash, threatened the press and got that canceled. So Parrot Fever has never been published. That was the third novel, the completion of Jan's trilogy. So Jan is being systematically blacked out and forgotten as well, and her books are being kept out of print. And one of the reasons I do a lot of writing about Jan Kerouac is I want people to remember her importance as a writer and her importance as a person who tried to save her father's papers. And she's in this poem, but only tangentially. Anyway, okay. Long introduction to a short poem. It's called Ferlinghetti. Lawrence never let me treat him like a famous man. I sat down to interview him, a green 27-year-old Midwestern kid. He said, "You need a better microphone than that." I said, "I don't know where to get one." He said, "Come on, I'll take you." And he led me 6 blocks away to an electronics store and showed me which one to buy. When Jan Kerouac was in town and shy of celebrity herself, Lawrence said, "Bring her to my house to meet Paula and we'll have coffee." I can't remember what we talked of that day, but I can still see Jan's smiling and laughing face in that well-worn house on Francisco, filled with old wood and books. He relaxed Jan as he relaxes everyone. That's one of his trade secrets. But it's also real, and that's another one of his secrets. I remember having breakfast with him and my mom in a little cafe on the Rue Saint-Louis in Old Quebec during the Rencontre Internationale Jack Kerouac, and how he delighted my old mother with jokes about the real maple syrup and stories he remembered of her hometown, Chicago. She told me afterward, I liked the way his eyes twinkled when he talked. And I remember his earnestness when he told Stella Kerouac in the old Pollard Library in Lowell that she had to let him publish Jack's manuscript, Poems All Sizes, and didn't falter under her Greek anger because he knew he was in the right. And I remember him telling me, with a grim face, in the offices of City Lights during the first Gulf War, that it was time for poets to end their silence and speak up about things that matter. "I'm still waiting," he said. And God bless him, he's still waiting now, 100 years after his birth, and it's high time we gave him what he asked for.
All right. Thank you. All right, Gerald. Jerry?
Jerry. And let me just say, I believe in what Lawrence said, which I recorded in that poem, that as writers and poets, we have to speak about things that matter. And that's why I write books like Kerouac, The Last Quarter Century. People may say, why are you writing these books? You're just trying to stir up trouble. Lawrence Ferlinghetti said it. We're writers. We need to write about things that matter. That's the line that I follow.
All right. Well, thanks so much for stopping by. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
All right.